Thanks, Curly. I'm going to be speaking about some work I recently completed with Nikita Blinov, who was recently here, in regards to thermal relics that are lighter than MeV with a particular. Is working? Uh-oh. Let's see if it's actually not working anymore. Sorry.
Was it working
So maybe it's your computer, it's not this, it's not working.
Hold on, let me see if I can fix this.
You were going to pay for the technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Let me try using this one.
Technical difficulties.
He's going to need to resolve them and I'll end your welcome.
Yes.
Oh, good, this one's working. Okay. Yeah, so like I was saying, with a particular emphasis on thermal dark matter below an MeV. So to begin, the viable mass range for dark matter is obscenely unconstrained. It can be as light as something is around 10 to minus 31 GeV, below which point it starts disrupting the stellar kinematics of dwarf galaxies. It can be as heavy as roughly 10 solar masses, above which point you start becoming constrained from microlensing searches and or microlensing constraints and macho searches. But anything at the beginning and between here is game. What's been happening for the past several decades is using well-motivated models to guide one's thinking within this mass space. So most famously, there's the QCD axion motivating dark matter masses often below the EV scale. There's the canonical WIMP motivating dark matter masses typically around the weak scale. However, direct detection experiments have been casting doubt on the standard vanilla WIMP. So if you're looking for another thing to guide your thinking, maybe some model points you here. For every model that points you here, there are 10 others that point you elsewhere. So if you want a nice organizing principle that's analogous to the WIMP case that will narrow the viable mass range, a good organizing principle is just demanding thermal contact. So zooming in on this a little bit, what people typically mean when they say the viable thermal mass range is typically things ranging from an MeV to 100 TeV. Things typically heavier than 100 TeV, assuming standard cosmology, tend to be overabundant. And things typically lighter than an MeV are said to run into problems with BBN and CMB, which is usually driven from considerations of ineffective or just indirect measurements of the expansion rate of the universe. So this is the mass range I'm going to be focusing on for the majority or for the entirety of my talk. And I should say also, this is not a main motivation for my talk, but I should say that recently there have been there's been a lot of work to try to propose experiments to directly search for light particle dark matter below the MeV scale. However, it's still a relatively unanswered question what viable models live down here. So what models, even if you could build an experiment that would have sensitivity, cosmologically, what models can live down here? I'll also say just more generally, the dark matter community at large is interested in light dark matter. So for instance, if a single line on a plot denotes a certain level of excitement, imagine what 30 lines on a plot denotes. So this is just a figure from the recent Cosmic Visions report earlier this year. I'm just showing it to illustrate the fact that the dark matter community is very interested in prospects for detecting light dark matter, building precise targets for dark matter. This is not going to be the main driving part of my talk. I'm just going to be interested in more of like an academic question, but this is just simply to illustrate the fact that people care about this. So before I get into the main meat of my talk, I've been using the phrase thermal dark matter. So let me define what I mean by that. So I think a good working definition of thermal dark matter is that where dark matter acquired its cosmological abundance through thermal contact with the Standard Model bath at large temperatures. Here by large temperatures, I mean temperatures much greater than the dark matter mass. A more colloquial way to say this is thermal dark matter is dark matter that was in full relativistic thermal glory with the Standard Model before freezing out in kind of the standard WIMP-like way. So these are the definitions I'm going to be taking for thermal dark matter and using for the rest of my talk. So with that, this is the brief outline of my talk. I'll be speaking about the standard constraints on sub-MeV thermal relics. So what people typically mean when they talk about the cosmological constraints on light thermal relics. Then I'll be proposing a simple loophole, which I'll be calling delayed equilibration for probably what will become obvious reasons. And then finally, I'll explore some models that realize this loophole. Okay, so to begin, what do people typically think of for the cosmological constraints on light sub-MeV thermal relics? Like I was saying, this is largely driven from an effective, or the effective number of neutrino species, which during the early universe is driven from indirect observations of the expansion rate of the universe. So during radiation domination, if Hubble is just dictated by the radiation energy density, I can define the radiation energy density as a piece coming from photons and a piece coming from something else. Usually the something else is just three generations of standard model neutrinos. I'm going to be taking a convention where ineffective is really defining Hubble during radiation domination as a function of time. You often hear people say that ineffective is a number that I measure at the time of relevant for the CMB, so it's a number I measure at recombination. However, I'm taking this more fluid definition because, you know, I can think of ineffective as just parameterizing Hubble. Hubble is a dynamical quantity, so in this sense, my convention will be taking ineffective as a dynamical quantity. So for instance, ineffective at the time of BBN might be different than ineffective at the time of the CMB, given some additional new physics. In the standard model, ineffective is predicted to be very close to 3, corresponding to the 3 generations of standard model neutrinos, a little bit greater than 3 just due to the fact that neutrinos don't perfectly decouple once they're approximately decoupled. And you can imagine any kind of deviations to this standard model prediction from new physics. The deviations that people typically worry about come in one of two classes. So one, I can just imagine having some additional dark radiation, so some new relativistic degrees of freedom that contribute to the energy density at early times, or I can have what I'm calling entropy shuffling, where I shuffle entropy between the neutrino and the photon sector. I mess with the relative temperature ratio of neutrinos relative to photons. Maybe I heat up one sector but not the other. This can also at late times lead to deviations in ineffective. So to get a good idea of how ineffective can be affected by the presence of new light physics, it's important just to keep in mind a few important scales. So I'm going to be focusing on light sub-MeV thermal dark matter. By the definition that I gave you at the beginning of this talk, this means that it's in equilibrium with the standard model before it's freezing out. But it's a model input of my theory, so when did dark matter and the standard model enter equilibrium? When did they actually equilibrate with each other? This is something your model has to tell you. And then the rest of these scales here are standard model scales. There's a scale associated with neutrinos and photons decoupling, which happens at a couple MeV. There's a scale at which nucleosynthesis has effectively concluded, which is roughly tens of keV, or just roughly 50 keV. And then there's a temperature associated with the physics of CMB, where recombination happens at roughly an EV. But just to simplify this even further, let me focus on these two important scales here. So when did dark matter and the standard model equilibrate? And how does this compare to the expected point of when neutrinos and photons decouple? So the standard in the standard studies, when people think about how light relics, any light thermal relic, can lead to a deviation in ineffective, this is the standard assumption. Let's say I'm focusing on sub-MeV dark matter. It's significantly lighter than an MeV, so it's significantly lighter than the scale at which neutrinos and photons decouple, and it's thermal, which means it's definitely equilibrated down here, and the standard assumption is to take the dark matter and the standard model equilibrated at much higher temperatures, so well before neutrinos and photons decouple. Let me also take, just as a simplifying assumption, that the thing that the dark matter is thermally equilibrating with are standard model neutrinos. I only have a couple choices at low temperatures, but this is one of the standard routes that people often consider. So let me make this standard choice. Under these assumptions, it's just a very simple calculation to see how ineffective is changed, but just uses conservation of co-moving entropy density. And what a simple calculation shows is that at late times, what's going to happen is that this dark light sub-MeV dark matter is going to dump its entropy into the neutrino bath, heat up the neutrinos relative to the photons, which will lead to a relative increase in ineffective. And the predicted deviation in ineffective is the standard model value of around 3 times some additional factor, where this factor depends on the degrees of freedom in this light dark matter sector, this G sub dm here, and raised to the 4/3 power. So if you can, try to remember this 4/3 power, because I'm going to be contrasting it with a very similar equation later in my talk. But the basic point is that in this minimal type model, if I'm trying to investigate what are the effects of at least one sub-MeV degree of freedom, if I demand there's at least one degree of freedom here that does this, this is a minimal deviation of delta ineffective at the level of 0.8.
Sorry, are you assuming that the delta level is actually the same sector?
For this simplifying case, yes. In the case where, for instance, if it coupled to both photons and neutrinos at late times, this would effectively act as a gate to equilibrate the neutrinos to the photon temperature. Yeah. This would mess with ineffective. People typically say,
how can you do it to couple on to neutrinos and not to electrons?
Well, you will have to couple two electrons at the end of the day. But in simple models, you can imagine that I've integrated out some right-handed neutrinos. This can do, for instance, generate a loop-induced coupling to electrons. These couplings are generally go like mass of the electron times mass of the neutrino over mw squared, or weak scale squared. So they're typically very suppressed.
So there is right-hand neutrino. Dark matter is right-hand neutrino.
No, right now I'm just making the assumption. Let's imagine it only has a coupling that's, from a thermal perspective, from a cosmological perspective, the only relevant one is neutrinos. Gauge invariance is going to tell you it should have some other interactions. But if I imagine that the interaction is mediated via, is really coming from a coupling between dark matter and right-handed neutrinos, then I can integrate out the right-handed neutrinos below a certain scale. This gives me an interaction between dark matter and electrons. That interaction is typically subdominant and not thermally important. But this is one of the two standard assumptions that people make in typical studies. They say, I'm not going to think about a specific model, but let me just imagine that dark matter was strongly enough coupled to neutrinos, but not to electrons, to equilibrate with neutrinos. This is the minimal prediction. If for instance, it was coupled to electrons and photons, ineffective would become smaller because it would effectively heat up the photons compared to the neutrinos. But this is, let me just work with this simplifying assumption because it's going to be more closely tied to what I'm interested in later on. So the question is, given this simple model and given this minimum deviation ineffective, okay, this is my minimal prediction. How is this minimal prediction constrained experimentally or observationally? So what can I say about cosmology to constrain this? What's wrong?
Yeah.
Nothing. Well, I'm just taking this as a simple example. You can have a case, if it coupled both to neutrinos and photons, this would equilibrate neutrinos and photons at late times. And in the standard model, neutrinos are known to be a little bit colder than photons because, for instance, once you drop below the electron mass threshold, it heats up the photons compared to neutrinos.
Is the reactor the proton to neutron ratio, for example?
What was that?
It will alter the proton to neutron ratio.
Well, that freezes out at a couple MeV. So it depends. It depends on when I'm messing with this temperature ratio. But I'll be talking about all the physics that is constraining this at certain epochs. Yeah. So actually, to begin with that, how are such deviations constrained experimentally? One standard pillar to consider is just the physics of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, or BBN, or the formation of light nuclei. So one of the standard abundances that people consider for BBN is that of helium-4. And the standard story for helium-4 is that, as you were saying, neutrons and protons are freezing out at some point. In the early universe, they're just interconverting through weak scale processes. At some point, these processes freeze out, and this is generically expected to happen at around an MeV. After this point, the neutron to proton ratio is frozen out, and I can estimate this neutron to proton ratio as roughly just a ratio of Boltzmann factors. So it depends on the neutron to proton mass difference, the temperature at freeze out, which is roughly an MeV. And this is predicted roughly to be around 1/7 in the standard model. Then it's generically true. So I should say this notation y sub p denotes the helium-4 mass fraction compared to all baryons. It's generically true that all these frozen out neutrons after this quantity is frozen out end up in helium-4. Something like 30% of them decay away before this happens, but it's approximately true that most of them end up in helium-4 just due to the fact that helium-4 has a very large binding energy per mass. So it's very strongly held for how light it is. And so therefore, from a simple counting argument, I can estimate what is the helium-4 abundance based on the neutron to proton ratio. And taking this simple estimate, I plug it into here, and this is my standard model prediction, which is roughly 1/4. So the standard model prediction for the helium-4 relative mass fraction is 1/4. And I'm not going to go into how the actual indirect experimental observations determine this, but it's quite remarkable when you think about it. You have to look in very low metallicity systems at things like recombination emission lines and absorption lines, but you're able to determine the primordial helium-4 abundance, and it tends to agree with this standard model prediction. Another abundance that is often considered is that of deuterium. So deuterium is important because it's what is inevitably being it's one of the first steps that you do, and it's used to build up heavier elements. So it's, for instance, it's used to build up things like helium-4. However, there's a conspiracy of a couple small numbers in BBN, namely that deuterium has a very small binding energy and that the baryon to photon ratio is very tiny, meaning that there are a lot of photons that can easily break up deuterium, which leads to this, the famous deuterium bottleneck, which is basically the statement that although the binding energy of most of these nuclei is on the MeV scale, I would have expected BBN to start at an MeV, BBN doesn't, nucleosynthesis doesn't really start until roughly 100 keV, because that's when these processes that break up deuterium freeze out. So basically the statement is, unlike helium-4, once made, deuterium is easily destroyed. And so when it stops being destroyed, that's when nucleosynthesis can actually begin. Also for that same fact, for the remainder of nucleosynthesis, deuterium's burning away. So if you look at the abundances evolving as a function of time, deuterium is dying away. And these processes shut off at roughly 50 keV or a few tens of keV, at which point the abundances of these light nuclei are more or less locked in. So then you can ask, how can deviations to ineffective, or more generally deviations to Hubble, lead to deviations in these predicted abundances? So here's a figure from a paper from Steigman a few years ago. They were considering this same scenario I was mentioning, where you have some light chi that's thermally coupled to neutrinos. Don't worry about the model. These different colors correspond to different degrees of freedom in the hidden sector, but the basic trend here is that if I go to the left, ineffective is increasing. And then this is the predicted deviation in helium-4 and deuterium. So you can see what happens with helium-4, for instance. Helium-4, the predicted helium-4 abundance is increased. This is simple to understand simply from the fact that if my universe is expanding more rapidly, neutrons and protons freeze out sooner. The neutron to proton ratio at freeze out is bigger, and this is largely what goes in predicting the helium-4 abundance. So helium-4 is increased. Similarly, for deuterium, larger values of ineffective correspond to more rapidly expanding universe across a finite range of temperature scales. So the universe expands through the point of deuterium burning more rapidly. So I have less time to burn deuterium and a higher predicted deuterium abundance as well. So the basic statement is ineffective alters these abundances significantly. So you can make a claim like this. You can say, OK, let's say I had a light relic coupled to neutrinos. As it becomes lighter, the different colors corresponded. They were considering different internal degrees of different number of degrees of freedom of this light thing. So I forget real scalar, complex scalar. As you go up, it becomes a bigger multiplicity hidden sector. So the change to the expansion rate's bigger. That's the same thing for these three lines as well. Different numbers of spins. For this particle. So you can set a constraint like this, where you can effectively say a very light particle would predict some deviation in ineffective. There's a viable range of ineffective just from measuring or inferring the primordial abundances of things. And for instance, the most up-to-date bound, from 2015, is this one. So this says that ineffective at temperatures ranging from a couple MeV to roughly 50 keV should be in the range of roughly 2.85 plus or minus 0.28 at the one sigma level. This floats around a little bit from year to year. I mean, there's some systematic uncertainty on this. However, I'm not going to be terribly interested in what the actual number of this is. I'm just going to take this at face value, and its precise value won't really matter for me in a qualitative way. I'm just going to see how does this affect, for instance, what kind of model building I have to do down the road. So this is the story for BBN. So the CMB is also very powerful in constraining deviations ineffective at much lower temperatures. So the standard physics for CMB is that of diffusion damping, or what's often called silk damping, named after its discoverer, Joseph Silk. But it's basically the physics of hot photons diffusing out of gravitational wells. And as they're diffusing out of gravitational wells, they're sloshing around electrons. They're washing away anisotropies exponentially that are smaller than the corresponding diffusion length of these photons. So the diffusion length is really what's setting away what scales you can wash away power on from these types of processes. So that's an important scale to consider. So I'm going to write the diffusion length, for instance, as R sub d. And because this is like a random walk, like a stochastic process, I can write this diffusion length as a square root of number of Thomson scatters off electrons times the mean free path of these photons, With a little bit of algebra, I can write this like the square root of the mean free path over Hubble. Okay, and then let me write the mean free path as 1 over the free electron number density times the Thomson cross-section. So basically, at the end of the day, this doesn't really matter for me qualitatively, but the diffusion length will go like square root of 1 over Hubble. Of course, this is not what I actually measure on the sky. What you measure on the sky is the corresponding angular scale. So this diffusion length over the distance to the CMB, or the angular distance to the surface of last scattering. So this is the angular scale that will be imprinted on the actual thing that I measure. And the problem here is that it depends on this parameter that's a priori not independently determined from the data. So d sub a is the distance to last scattering. For instance, it depends on the evolution of dark energy from last scattering to today, and it's not independently determined. So I want to find a way to get rid of my ignorance about this quantity. So for instance, you can consider another associated scale. Another important scale to consider is that of the sound horizon. This is just the maximum size at which I can imprint anisotropies on the CMB, roughly. So it should go like 1 over Hubble, and the corresponding angular scale similarly goes like this 1 over Hubble sound horizon length scale over the same distance to the surface of last scattering. So because these things have the same dependence on this d sub a, which I was saying you don't have independent knowledge of, you can consider the ratio of these two quantities. The dependence on d sub a drops out. And because r sub s, the sound horizon length, goes like 1 over Hubble, I get a square root of Hubble upstairs in this ratio. And I should also say, I didn't mention this point, which was basically the statement that theta s, the angular scale associated with the sound horizon, is physically very measurable in the CMB. It's essentially the position in L space, the angular position of the first big acoustic peak. So in your CMB fits, if you want to get the first acoustic peak right, it's largely fixing theta s. So what this relation tells you down here then is that for a fixed theta s, bigger values of Hubble predict more effective diffusion damping. So what you expect, therefore, is that if ineffective is significantly greater than 3, or if Hubble is much bigger at the time of recombination or around recombination, this leads to an increased effectiveness of silk damping. I'm going to wash away this high L power more effectively in my CMB fits. And so this actually was surprisingly wasn't easy for people to understand, even people doing the CMB fits, because there's a lot of moving parts. But here's a paper that kind of argued for this logic. So look at this. If you look, this is the CMB angular power spectrum, the temperature anisotropy power spectrum. So if you look at the power as a function of L, this top purple line, which you can kind of, or this top red line going to the bottom purple line, so going from here to here, corresponds to dialing up ineffective. And you can see the major effect is mostly washing away power on this high L damping tail, or what's called the damping tail of the CMB. So this allows, for instance, measurements of the CMB to be sensitive to ineffective. This is really the physics that's governing it. And here I just pulled out the standard constraint from the recent Planck paper from a few years ago, that ineffective at recombination, so at temperatures around EV, should be around 3.15 plus or minus 0.23 at 1 sigma. Of course, there are many different combinations of data sets you can use. You can include the BAO, you can do all these things. The central value for this tends to float around. The spread floats around a little bit. However, similar to the BBN constraint, I'm just going to take this at face value and see what it says about what I have to do for model building. The precise value of this constraint is not going to be qualitatively important for me.
Is that the only way an effective changes the spectrum?
It's kind of difficult.
Is that really where that constraint comes from?
That's dominantly that's the physics that's governing it. The CMB is much more difficult than BBN because you have so many moving knobs. So you have to say, if I'm going to change ineffective, I'm generically going to, and you have to say, like, what else am I keeping fixed? So the point was, if you're keeping the fit to the first peak fixed, then really the physics is, if I change up ineffective, keeping this fit here good, then it's just increasing the effectiveness of diffusion damping. So that is really the physics if, for instance, this is fixed. But you didn't have to do that, and then a lot of things can move around, and then the physics does change a little bit. So just to recap, so what I've told you is that considerations of BBN and the CMB constrain ineffective to be around the standard model prediction at different epochs. And for instance, the minimal model that I gave you earlier of a single degree of freedom thermally coupled to standard model neutrinos predicts a minimum deviation of delta ineffective at the level of 0.8, which is inconsistent with these measurements. So this has led people for many years to make the following claim, that thermal dark matter should be heavier than an MeV. This is kind of a standard thing you hear in the dark matter community. And so this is a claim that I want to investigate and I want to point out a loophole for. I didn't talk about things coupled to electrons and photons, but there's a similar argument for this as well, and I glossed over many details. But this is a claim more or less at the end of the day, that you can't have sub-MeV thermal dark matter just dominantly due to these cosmological considerations. This is what does it in a model-independent way, typically. So I want to point out a loophole, which I'm going to be referring to as delayed equilibration. To begin the discussion on this loophole, let me just ask a basic question, which is, how ubiquitous was it, that standard assumption I made a few slides ago? Namely, how natural was it that the dark matter in the standard model equilibrated well before neutrinos and photons decoupled? So you can ask, why am I asking this question? Well, here's a slide that I had earlier in my talk. This was the standard assumption that people often make, at least for coupling to neutrinos. Let's say it thermally equilibrates with neutrinos well before neutrino-photon decoupling. That led to this deviation ineffective. And if you go through the calculation, you'll see that these two things are really in one-to-one correspondence with each other. So this ordering is really driving this calculation ineffective. So I want to ask how natural is this ordering?
You're also assuming that remember the old days that you run the highest term, you have a decoupled before the PCB phase transition.
Yeah, because then you have a lot of, you sweep, right? You go through a lot of, there's essentially a bunch of little entropy dumps in the standard model. You go from like G star of 100 to G star of 10. This makes, if something decouples early, it makes that thing that decouples early much colder. I will be encompassing part of that parameter space, but I'm keeping the assumption that by definition, thermal dark matter, if it's below an MeV, has to be in thermal equilibrium below an MeV. So it's at the same temperature as some standard model species below the MeV. So it's not doing that where I decouple early. I really am coupled at the sub-MeV scale. So that is a constraint, but I wouldn't say that's a loophole for thermal dark matter, because now you're doing something that's, you're decoupling, so you're no longer thermal at low temperatures. That's what I would say. So to investigate whether or not this ordering of scales is natural, let me just remind people of the physics of light mediators. So this is the famous Lee-Weinberg bound, which simply says that if dark matter was thermally coupled to the standard model through the weak force, and let's say I demand that these couplings governing this annihilation process at freeze-out are smaller than order one, what the Lee-Weinberg bound says parametrically, that the dark matter mass, to get the right relic abundance, has to be heavier than the weak scale squared over this geometric mean, where this is temperature at matter radiation equality, which is about 0.8 eV. This is the Planck mass. This geometric mean is roughly 10 TeV. So 100 GeV squared over 10 TeV is a GeV. So this bound says that for thermal dark matter to be electroweakly coupled to the standard model has to be heavier than a GeV. Equivalently, if I have thermal dark matter that's lighter than a GeV, this requires the presence of new light mediators to not overclose. So for dark matter that's significantly lighter than a GeV, it kind of naturally points to mediators here that I'm writing as phi close to the dark matter mass. So let me use light mediators motivated by light dark matter and see how this changes the equilibration story. So by equilibration, I'm going to mean not how things are decoupling, not how things are going out of equilibrium, but how things are coming into equilibrium. How did they equilibrate in the first place from the point of view of light mediators, for instance? So it's generically true that things tend to equilibrate when they're relativistic. Because when you become non-relativistic, you start becoming Boltzmann suppressed, or you have some additional temperature dependence, things like this. So things tend to equilibrate when they're relativistic. So let me write the rates, gamma, to equilibrate while relativistic as various forms. So in the case that equilibration is going to happen through elastic scattering, this goes like temperature. In the case that it goes, for instance, comes from the decays or an inverse decays of a light mediator into the standard model and the relativistic limit, this rate goes like 1 over temperature. And let me contrast this to analogous rates in the case of some contact operator where I have some very heavy mediator. For a very heavy mediator, that thing's very heavy, I can integrate it out. And essentially, the rate to equilibrate is going to have some extra scale suppression downstairs, so I have some additional temperature dependence. And of course, I want to compare this to Hubble, and its temperature dependence goes as T squared. So the statement is, light mediators are falling less rapidly in temperature than Hubble is. Heavy mediators are leading to equilibration rates that are falling more rapidly than Hubble is. So if I consider rates like gamma over Hubble, or the ratio gamma over Hubble, let's say this dashed line is 1. Above this dashed line, I tend to be efficient at equilibrating, and I'm equilibrated. Below this dashed line, I'm not efficient, and I'm decoupled. So the story for light mediators is that I naturally gain on Hubble. So I come into equilibrium, and then I drop below some mass scale. Let's say the temperature drops below the mass of some mediator. The mediator becomes heavy. Then I start falling more rapidly than Hubble, and I decouple later. And contrast this with the case of a heavy mediator, where I'm just always more, I'm falling more rapidly than Hubble. So for a heavy mediator, if I was equilibrated at some point, and I want to ask, was I equilibrated at an earlier time? Well, if that mediator were still heavy, then I definitely am. So if you can take one point away from this part of my talk, it would be the following, that light thermal dark matter that naturally motivates light mediators naturally comes into equilibrium, enters equilibrium, of course, assuming that the reheat temperature of the universe is high enough. Assuming that I can start to the left of this point here, light thermal dark matter naturally comes in before it decouples. So I'm gonna motivate this from a model building perspective later, but let me just investigate what happens if this point of equilibration, so when I enter equilibrium in the standard model, happens after neutrino photon decoupling, because that would flip that ordering that I was showing earlier. So namely, this was the standard ordering. I want to consider this flipped ordering, the non-standard assumption, where neutrinos and photons first decouple at a couple MeV, then dark matter and, let's say, standard model neutrinos equilibrate below an MeV, and these temperatures are all much greater than the dark matter mass itself, which is significantly lighter than the MeV scale. Okay, as you're going to see, this is going to result in some additional sensitivity to physics in the ultraviolet. Namely, with this ordering, I'm going to become a sensitive to roughly what the initial dark matter temperature is before equilibration. So let me take the assumption that the initial dark matter temperature in the dark matter sector is much colder than the photons. This is not the case when they're equilibrated, but before they're equilibrated. Let me take this assumption. So what I'm showing here in this figure are ratios of temperatures. So I'm showing this C sub I corresponds to a temperature sub I, where I is going to be a certain species, either the neutrinos or the dark matter chi, normalized by the photon temperature. So one means you're at the same temperature as photons. Below one means you're colder. So this dotted line shows the standard model expectation for the neutrino to photon temperature ratio. Of course, at early times, it's one. Neutrinos are the same temperature as photons. Once I drop below the electron threshold, and neutrinos are already decoupled at this point, electrons heat up the photons compared to the neutrinos, and this goes to this famous value 4/11 to the 1/3, which is roughly 0.7. So this is the standard model expectation for the evolution of the neutrino temperature compared to the photon temperature as a function of falling photon temperature to the right. Now let me ask what happens when the neutrinos, they've already decoupled, but now after they've decoupled, they equilibrate with some light, cold bath. So this is what's going to happen. So the neutrinos are going to track their standard model expectation. This is still the standard model value here, just for comparison. But let's say they equilibrate with some very cold chi sector, or dark matter sector. Well, if this dark matter sector is very cold, the standard model neutrinos have to heat up the dark matter, and this costs the neutrinos thermal energy. So it's going to cool the standard model neutrinos relative to the photons. So equilibration is going to cool the neutrinos. So that's the first step here. Equilibration heats the dark matter, cools the standard model neutrinos. And then as I drop below mass thresholds, let's say I drop below the mass of the dark matter chi, it will dump its entropy back into the standard model neutrinos. It will heat up the neutrinos. Let's say I drop below another mass threshold corresponding to some light mediator. That mediator will also dump its entropy in the standard model neutrinos. And so there's a later heating that happens as things decouple. So decoupling heats the standard model neutrinos back up. So the basic point of this mechanism that I'm going to be talking about is that if I equilibrate late and the thing is cold, then equilibration and decoupling first cools, then later heats up the standard model neutrinos. This process has an overall net increase in entropy. So there's not a perfect cancellation because entropy tends to increase a little bit in this process. There's an overall net increase in the neutrino temperature compared to the standard model, which will lead to some overall irreducible increase in ineffective. But the main point is that there's some slight cancellation between these two effects. So let me give you some semi-analytic understanding of what happens at effective. So to do that, this is just some notation. So G star nu is the number of degrees of freedom of neutrinos in the standard model, three generations of left-handed fermions, And I'm defining this temperature ratio C chi zero as the dark matter to photon temperature ratio before equilibration, which I'm treating as more or less a free parameter, because it has to be, you know, it's sensitive to, you know, what happened after inflation, or maybe the thing decoupled very early and cooled down. So it's more or less a free knob in my theory from a low energy perspective. And then, so the evolution of ineffective is the following. So here I'm writing T chi equilibrium as the temperature at which the chi's equilibrate with the standard model. So a temperature is greater than the equilibrium temperature. I'm not equilibrated. And this is how what ineffective looks like. And this is just the generic form for any uncoupled dark radiation. If I treated this as a free parameter, I can just make that dark radiation colder. It's not yet coupled to the standard model. This is the standard form. However, you're going to reach a point once I drop below this equilibration temperature that the two sectors are going to equilibrate, and ineffective turns into the following formula, which you'll notice is exactly the same as the first one. So this is true as long as the states in the hidden sector are still relativistic, but this is after equilibration. The reason that this hasn't changed is approximately because when things equilibrate when they're relativistic, the total system between the two equilibrating species approximately conserves co-moving energy density. Because ineffective is something that's reflective of energy density, it doesn't change. So this is a kind of a cool side note, not related to my dark matter discussion. But imagine that I had a bunch of chi's that were much lighter than an EV. Okay, this tells me that if they started out, basically, if they're lighter than an EV, they're not going to become non-relativistic during CMB. And what this tells me is that I could have an unlimited amount of degrees of freedom completely thermally equilibrate with the standard model of neutrinos as long as the initial temperature ratio is very small. Because if the initial temperature ratio is very small, in fact, I can have a huge number of degrees of freedom equilibrate with the standard model of neutrinos, but predict a delta ineffective of zero. So that's just kind of a cool side note. But of course, dark matter has to turn non-relativistic before recombination. And when this happens, so when these chi's turn non-relativistic, they heat up the neutrinos a little bit by dumping their entropy back in. And you can see, even if I dial this initial temperature ratio to zero, there's still some irreducible deviation in ineffective, which is dictated by the number of degrees of freedom in the chi sector. This is what this actually solving numerically a Boltzmann equation and seeing these horizontal lines are these semi-analytic estimates. But numerically solving a Boltzmann equation and seeing what ineffective looks like as a function of falling temperature to the right or time. That's what this looks like. The standard assumption, as I was saying, is to assume that equilibration happens before neutrino decoupling. And this was, I made this for a hidden sector for something like a little less than 3 degrees of freedom in the hidden sector, which was driven by a specific model that I was considering. But this is the standard prediction in ineffective. However, if I just flip these scales and assume that the initial temperature ratio is very small, then you can see that initially the deviation in ineffective is zero. Then it gets a little bit higher as I start dropping below mass thresholds. And if you go back here, take this to zero, okay? That's the minimal deviation in ineffective. G star nu is 21/4, so 1 over G star nu is 421. 4 over 21. So the basic point here, I told you a while ago in my talk to remember a 4/3. So this case in the mechanism I've been talking about looks like an identical deviation in effective, except now the 4/3 has turned into a 1/3. And this is basically due to the slight cancellation between heating and cooling. So the interesting thing about this model is if I demand at least 1 degree of freedom, there's a minimum deviation in effective at the level of roughly 0.2. Before, in the standard case, this was like 3.78. Now the minimum deviation is like 3.18. So the basic statement from this is that I can easily have several new degrees of freedom that do this and that are okay from a point of view of BBN and CMB from constraints on ineffective. However, this is something like a 10% deviation. In the next few years, we're going to be sensitive to 1% deviations once this full set of ground-based CMB telescopes turn on, CMB stage 4. And we'll be sensitive to delta ineffective at the 1% level. So in fact, CMB stage 4 will generically test the entire set of these models, but yet, as of now, they are not excluded.
So what type of model do you have in mind more specifically?
I'm about to get the model building. I'll get to that. Yeah.
From what you've shown us, it's fair to say you need a mediator that is not initially any.
But I would argue that if something's light, there's no good reason to think it was in equilibrium if the reheat temperature of the universe is high enough. So that was That was the point of that first plot.
Right.
Things, right.
Is it fair to say its coupling has to be somewhere in the intermediate zone where it's, you know, not 2D coupled?
Yes, exactly.
Be,
yeah. So this, I would say this scenario is predictive because it predicts a range of couplings.
Okay.
So it has to be big enough to equilibrate at some point, but not too big to equilibrate too soon. So there will be a spread of a couple orders of magnitude in the predicted couplings, which I'll also get to when I actually talk about the specific models. So first, let me just, before I get to the models, let me give you an overview of the thermal history that I'm imagining. So this is the standard WIMP, co-moving number density as a function of 1 over temperature, tracks equilibrium, freezes out, yada, yada. Another well-known mechanism is freeze-in. This is something where you just have leakage from the standard model into the hidden sector, out of equilibrium populating the hidden sector, but it never actually tracks an equilibrium density. And what I'm saying is that if a WIMP, I'm going to be imagining a similar scenario, so something that equilibrates is in equilibrium while relativistic, decouples, freezes out just like a WIMP. However, if this WIMP-like thing is light enough, what I'm saying is that this is really only half the story. So if I go back early enough in time, what I'll show you more in these models is that there was no good reason to think that these things were in equilibrium with the standard model, at which point you have one of two choices. The dark matter sector was hotter or it was colder. If it was hotter, deviations in effect had become worse or more constrained. If it was colder, then I alleviate a lot of these constraints. So this is the scenario I'm imagining. I enter the WIMP-like regime. It's definitely not freezing. I relativistically equilibrate, then I decouple. But the basic point is I just want this point of equilibration to have to happen after neutrino photon decoupling, which is at a couple MeV. OK. Let me begin what I think, what kinds of models could potentially do this. So first, let's just do a parametric estimate. And to do that, let me remind you of the WIMP miracle. So the WIMP miracle is just simply the fact that if had a cross-section that goes like alpha freeze out squared over the dark matter mass squared, then they get the right relic abundance today that the dark matter mass has to be parametrically related to this coupling alpha freeze out times this geometric mean, which earlier I was saying is roughly 10 TeV. However, now let me supplement the standard thing with the physics of equilibration. Sorry, I've switched notations a little bit here. So now TKE is the equilibration temperature. So standing for anything with a KE stands for kinetic equilibrium or kinetic equilibration. So let me imagine that equilibration happens through the elastic scattering of mediated via some light mediator. Equilibration will tend to happen when things are relativistic. And by definition, it's comparable to Hubble at the equilibration temperature. So this is the more or less the criteria for equilibrating relativistically. I can rewrite these two equations in the following form. In fact, taking this and plugging into this, you can rewrite it in this following form where to get the right relic abundance, the dark matter mass has to be related to these ratios of couplings, those governing freeze out and those governing equilibration, times this new geometric mean where, once again, this is the temperature at equilibration. So if I'm interested in the case where equilibration happens below a couple MeV, I plug that into here, and this tells me that my thermal dark matter, no one yell at me yet, has to be lighter than a KeV times this ratio of couplings. Of course, thermal dark matter can't be, generically runs into problems from warm dark matter considerations. So to avoid warm dark matter bounds, what this simple parametric estimate tells me is I need some hierarchy between my couplings governing freeze out and those governing equilibration, which is kind of obvious, but I thought, you know, this parametric estimate is illuminates something. So this tells me a direction to go in terms of model building. So I need a hierarchy between couplings of freeze out and equilibration. So one class of models that naturally does this is secluded dark matter, where I annihilate to some lighter hidden sector states, which have some feeble coupling with the standard model. Another natural class of models that do this is where thermal freeze out occurs near a resonance. Then I just kinematically enhance my freeze out rate compared to my scattering rates. Or I could imagine that freeze out proceeds in a sector governed by completely different couplings than those governing equilibration, something like a SIMP, which I think when Nikita was here, he talked about a little. So this is the class of models I'm going to be focusing on for my talk. So a secluded dark matter-like sector. So let me move on to my final section, which is just a brief discussion of models. And I'll begin with a toy model, then I'll begin with a more realistic, and then I'll end with a more realistic model. So a toy model, just to give you an idea of what parameter space can look like, and I'm just having some encoupling to neutrinos. It's not a full model. I'll get there eventually. But imagine that some light mediator, some light scalar phi, couples to fermionic dark matter chi and the standard model neutrinos, and that I'm also assume that this mediator is lighter than the dark matter chi. So Frieseout's going to proceed in this secluded dark matter-like way, where chis annihilate the pairs of phis. These phis later decay in the standard model neutrinos. To get the right relic abundance, this Yukawa between the dark matter and the mediator has to be in the 10 to the minus 5 ballpark for a KV dark matter mass. If the phi isn't too, too light, what's going to be the dominant process governing equilibration is decays and inverse decays in the standard model neutrinos. So this is what's going to equilibrate the two sectors. And there's a roughly a minimum size of this coupling that I need such that the sector equilibrates while everything's relativistic and I preserve this thermal wimp-like scenario. This minimum coupling is roughly 10 to the minus 11 for a KeV dark matter mass, and also assuming that the mediator and the dark matter are comparable to each other in mass. So now let me just show you what this parameter space looks like very briefly. So here I'm showing you the dark matter mass in KeV, and also on this axis the mass ratio between the dark matter and the mediator. Everywhere in this plot, I fixed this Yukawa lambda chi to give me the right relic abundance. Also, I fixed the Yukawa lambda nu, which is the standard model portal coupling to the neutrinos, such that I equilibrate while the dark matter is relativistic. So the range of couplings I'm considering is ranging from roughly 10 to the minus 8 down to a little bit below 10 to the minus 10 in the bottom left corner here. and then there are various constraints. The most important ones in this parameter space are if the dark matter is too light, it's ruled out from considerations of warm dark matter or observations of the Lyman alpha forest. If the mediator is too light in this model, it's a scalar, it will generate unsuppressed enhanced scattering rates of dark matter with itself at low temperatures. So this is constrained from observations of merging galaxy clusters. So for instance, the bullet cluster will have some upper bound on the self-scattering constraint, which will fixing to the thermal relic parameter space will be some upper bound on this mass ratio. And then there's ineffective as a strip in this parameter space and what it excludes, more or less because to alleviate the ineffective constraints, I want to equilibrate below a couple MeV while the dark matter is relativistic. If I'm up here close to an MeV, I'm equilibrating above a couple MeV. So this trick to avoid ineffective constraints loses out. So really, this strip will go from a couple hundred KeV to a couple MeV in what it excludes. But this is more or less open from a toy model perspective. So the relic abundance just depends on this lambda chi, because it's like a secluded dark matter-like thing. And I haven't specified them, but I'm just fixing them everywhere. These are essentially specified from demanding that equilibration happens while everything is relativistic. So this is making sure that the phi does decays and inverse decays into standard model neutrinos and equilibrates the two sectors while the whole sector is relativistic. Those are the size of the couplings I need.
So should that be like a lower bound?
It's a lower bound. I could equilibrate. I could say, well, I could turn lambda nu up to like 1, and then I'll equilibrate very, very early. This is kind of, I'm taking it to the minimum level, because first of all, I don't want to equilibrate when the dark matter's, when the temperature is a billion times larger than the dark matter mass, because I'm definitely equilibrating well above a couple MeV. So I'm just doing the minimal thing of equilibrating. Here I've set them so I'm equilibrating 3 or 4 times, at temperatures 3 or 4 times the dark matter mass. So I'm definitely in the relativistic limit for when things are equilibrating.
What are you assuming for this toy model, there's maximum 5 Higgs?
From just a thing I can write down to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, this is not cage invariant.
No, I know, yeah.
So even if you try to make it cage invariant,
yes.
I will mix with the Higgs, right?
Yes, there's some irreducible mixing with the standard model. So this point is just to show you the basic, what the parameter space might look like.
But there are going to be other constraints.
Yes.
For the mixing of the Higgs if you consider specific models.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So,
and I'm going to consider a specific model.
Okay.
And the mixing with the Higgs is going to turn out all the mixing with the standard model. If I'm not writing down a tree term, tree level term, I just imagine radiatively inducing these things. They're all going to be very suppressed by the neutrino mass. So they're all going to be suppressed by neutrino mass. So in fact, the mixing with the standard model is going to be tiny. At the level of like the effective sine theta, you can calculate in the model I'm about to talk about. So this is a little premature, but is at the level of like 10 to the minus 15 or something. It's very, very tiny.
Well, there may be constraints even at such small thing from things produced in supernova, because you have a very light particle, right? Phi is light.
Yes.
There may be force constraints even at that tiny mixing. Have you looked at those?
Well, in this model, I'm not, so in this less minimal model, I've not yet investigated every facet. I have looked at the dominant constraints. And essentially, because the mixing with the Higgs is irrelevant cosmologically, I'm assuming it's negligible. Well, I think fifth force aren't going to be. I'm imagining mediators in the range of like 100 keV, where I don't think fifth force are going to be a concern. But there's going to be stellar cooling,
yes.
And there's going to be supernova, and those I have considered. The dominant constraints are actually going to come from the couplings to neutrinos themselves and supernova. And the constraints from supernova, there's actually a quick calculation you can do. It's actually surprisingly weak for it's basically going to be a model of Majorans I'm talking about. But some light scalar that couples to neutrinos, the upper bound on the coupling is like roughly 10 to the minus 7. So up here, you're kind of in that region. Down here, your orders of magnitude below the standard supernova cooling bounds. So it's surprisingly weak compared to other things. But I have a backup slide if you want to see the generic estimate. And there are also papers that back this up with more detailed estimates as well. Okay, so let me just conclude with a more complete model. So I want something that couples to neutrinos. So let me write down a realistic model of neutrino masses. So I'm going to write down a model that preserves initially U1 lepton, or just lepton number. So I'm adding right-handed neutrinos, these capital Ns. And I'm assigning them a lepton number that's unbroken. So I'm also introducing a scalar sigma that has lepton number 2, such that I can write down this Yukawa interaction between the scalar and the right-handed neutrinos. And this is my neutrino sector Lagrangian. I'm going to imagine that sigma, which is this complex scalar, gets a VeV from its potential. So it's going to get a VeV F, and it's going to spontaneously break lepton number. It has a real component, imaginary component. In the limit that my full theory respects lepton number and I'm spontaneously breaking it, this J, this imaginary component, is a true massless Goldstone of the theory. However, what's often written down in these models, I mean, this is kind of a historical theory at this point for many decades, is to just write down something else in the theory that softly breaks lepton number. This can come from the scalar potential. This can come from other more exotic couplings. But something that just demotes this thing to a pseudo-Goldstone, gives it a small mass, in which case people call these Majorans. So this is a typical Majoran theory of neutrino masses. And neutrino masses are generated in kind of like a seesaw-like way. So in the standard seesaw limit, the mass of my right-handed neutrinos is just this Yukawa times the VeV. And the standard model neutrino masses are parametrically the Dirac mass squared, where this is the standard model Higgs VeV. This Yukawa is coming from here, over the right-handed neutrino mass. So this is the standard seesaw-like result. however, let me add to this theory my dark matter candidate, which I'm going to call Chi. And as my dark matter candidate, I'm just positing the existence of a new lepton. So imagine there's a new lepton. So it has lepton charge 1, but it's additionally charged under a Z2. So in this case, this is the only term I can write down. I'm charging under a Z2, obviously, because I want to make it stable. More specifically, I don't want it to mix. If it didn't have a Z2, it could just mix with the right-handed neutrino and the standard model neutrino. So I'm making its own isolated thing by adding an additional Z2. And so once sigma gets a VeV, this will also give mass to this new lepton, my dark matter candidate. and the important couplings that are going to be generated, or the one that I'll be interested in, is, for instance, the light Majoran J, this light pseudoscalar or pseudo-Goldstone, will have couplings to neutrinos and chis. And because it's part of this scalar that's responsible for giving these things masses, this Yukawa, for neutrinos, would go like M nu over F. For dark matter, we'll go like M dark matter or M chi over F. So let me move on to just give you a parametric estimate of where this model likes to live. To make our lives simple, let me imagine that the mass of the dark matter is comparable to the mass of the Majoran, is comparable to the temperature of equilibration. Obviously, this doesn't have to be the case, but I'm just doing this to make the algebra a little bit more simple. Equilibration, like the toy model, is going to happen through decays and inverse decays of the Majoran in the standard model neutrinos. This goes like the Yukawa, M nu over F squared times the dimensionable scale, only one being the dark matter mass. By definition, this equilibration rate is comparable to Hubble at the equilibration temperature, which I'm also saying is comparable to M chi. So it's M chi squared over M Planck. I can solve for F squared, or the scale of U1L breaking in this theory. And this tells me the values of F that I need for this to be in thermal story, to equilibrate before the dark matter turns non-relativistic. Freeze-out is going to proceed in a similar way compared to the toy model. annihilate the pairs of on-shell Majorans, which later decay to standard model neutrinos. Just to remind you again, here's the standard Wendt miracle estimate, if I can parameterize the cross-section like this. However, in this theory, this goes like 1 over f to the fourth. So my effective alpha freeze-out is like m chi over f quantity squared. And I can plug this into the Wendt miracle estimate and get an estimate for the values of m chi that I need for to have the right relic abundance. So this is a constraint on the relic abundance. This is a constraint on equilibration. I can take this, put it into here, and ask what do I expect for m chi for this to be a thermal scenario that gives me the right relic abundance? And this is what you get. So this is a constraint on the dark matter mass parametrically. So you have some large ratio of m Planck over temperature of matter radiation equality to the 1/4 times the standard model neutrino masses. So this just popped out of the theory. Let's just ask what this is. Call this 10 to the 19 and over 10 to the minus 8. It's rough, 10 to the minus 9, which is like an EV. So this is like 10 to the 28 to the 1/4, 10 to the 7. So this large prefactor is roughly 10 to the 7. The characteristic mass scale for standard model neutrino masses is like a tenth of an EV, so 10 to the minus 10 GeV. So 10 to the 7 times 10 to the minus 10 GeV, 10 to the minus 3 GeV is an MeV. So in fact, the MeV scale just kind of pops out of here by accident. If I would have been more realistic about these hierarchy of scales, demanding, for instance, that the mass of the chi is heavier than the Majorana, demanding that equilibration happens before all these mass scales, before I drop below these mass scales, this would have turned into an inequality. So there's just a weird little conspiracy in this model. It's just a conspiracy of these how these scales enter. It's really driven by the observed smallness of the standard model neutrino masses. But what this theory tells you is that you can only have a thermal dark matter scenario in this theory and get the right neutrino masses if the dark matter is lighter than an MeV. Let me just flash some constraints, which I've checked, and they're okay. There's supernova cooling, I was mentioning. There's also effects from neutrino scattering in the early universe. This can effectively delay free streaming of neutrinos in the early universe, and it can leave an imprint on the CMB. There are also effects from dark matter scattering off neutrinos. This has an interesting effect where it can, for instance, generate baryon acoustic-like features imprinted on the matter power spectrum. So from large scale, from large catalogs of galaxies, you're able to constrain such types of couplings. There are also just direct searches for Majorans and steril neutrinos, but I haven't had time to talk about in this talk, but happy to chat about after, is how these things are all okay. But these are all potential constraints in the model. So let me just conclude. So my summary is that the basic point of the study was just to show from a slightly model-independent way that the claim that sub-MeV thermal dark matter is not possible actually has a little loophole in it, which I think is naturally motivated, basically from the fact that in order to take advantage of that loophole, I had to equilibrate below the temperature neutrino-photon decoupling, and I argued that this is late equilibration is natural from the physics of light mediators, which are themselves motivated from light thermal dark matter. Like I was saying earlier to Joe, this scenario predicts a limited range for couplings. So unlike secluded dark matter, which typically just has a lower bound on the coupling, I also have an upper bound on the coupling because I don't want to equilibrate above a couple MeV. So this scenario is predictive, even though the couplings are pretty tiny. There's a limited range for what these couplings can be with a spread of a couple orders of magnitude. I also said, I kind of motivated at the beginning of my talk in one slide, I said, well, you know, there are experiments that are being built to these low threshold experiments to look for visible signals or recoil signals of dark matter scattering off low threshold targets. However, it's unfortunate. My model involves neutrino interactions, and there aren't a lot of neutrinos in these terrestrial experiments to scatter off of. So the most minimal models I talked about are not detectable via these direct detection experiments. However, I'm happy to chat about this after, but there are less minimal extensions you can do where you can take advantage of the loophole I've discussed, generate a thermal abundance of dark matter that's below an MeV, but then you just have to have, there's essentially more things you have to tack on to the theory, but you can build in detectable rates that are consistent with astrophysical or cosmological constraints. But I think more interestingly, this class of models is not definitively tested, but it will be robustly explored in upcoming CMB stage 4 experiments, which will have a part per 100 sensitivity and effective. And also, better bounds on warm dark matter as well, because I'm talking about thermal dark matter near the warm dark matter limit, so in the 100, 10 to 100 keV ballpark. So better observations of warm dark matter, maybe coming from 21 centimeter observations of the cosmic dark ages, will also help you have additional sensitivity to this parameter space as well. That's it. Thank you. Yeah.
So your toy models, do they have this very low T chi initial?
Yeah, so.
And can you say why?
So they all have this very low T chi initial, mainly because that's the only way I can get around ineffective. So this plot, so this is essentially showing that my T chi initial is very small, as you were saying. In that case, the initial temperature of the dark matter starts out very cold, and it cools the standard model neutrinos first. Decoupling will, you're jumping entropy into something, so it will generically heat something up. So if, for instance, chi was hotter than the neutrino bath, it would initially heat up the neutrino bath, then heat the neutrino bath up again. So I would just, the only thing I'd be doing in that scenario is heating up the neutrinos. It would be even a greater deviation and ineffective. But because I start out colder, it cools neutrinos when these two gases come into thermal contact. And that can counteract the later heating that changes. Because these two things counteract each other, there's a cancellation in how ineffective is modified. Mm-hmm. And so I had to take advantage of that. And that is essentially, I mean, the UV like boundary condition that I have to impose on these theories.
But in your toy models, how do you?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I could imagine one way of doing it that's simple, that was mentioned earlier. Like, for instance, if I was in thermal equilibrium in the very early universe, let's say around the weak scale, or just above a few hundred MeV, and then I decoupled before that point, then I'd have a lot of entropy dumps in the standard model that would cool me down. So if I was in thermal equilibrium at 500 MeV, at an MeV, I'm at roughly half the standard model temperature. And that would be enough to take advantage of this. So I didn't show this plot. But here's what parameter space looks like. So this is a function of chi zero, so this initial temperature, so how small does it have to be, as a function of the number of sub-MeV degrees of freedom. BBN has different bounds depending on whether or not decoupling happens before the end of BBN or after the end of BBN. But for instance, here's the standard Planck constraints. As long as chi chi zero is below 0.5, I mean, this thing is becoming close in how strong the constraint is, so I can have a few degrees of freedom down here. I saturate the effect when the temperature is very, very small. But already at a temperature ratio of 0.5, I'm okay.
Oh, you don't need something crazy small.
I don't need something crazy small. As long as it's much below, or you know, probably significantly smaller than a half, or that's probably good enough. I mean, there are also, you know, I didn't really specify it, but you can talk about scenarios of asymmetric reheating of two sectors that are not in thermal contact. So after an inflation, they just reheat to a different temperature. That's also possible, but then I'd have to talk about physics at higher scales, which I really wasn't interested in. So in this sense, I was kind of treating this as a free knob in my theory. And in fact, in the toy model that I was showing you, I was implicitly assuming that this guy was more or less to the left of a half.